Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Education, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. Today, I will be talking to Professor Christian Udesen about his new edited volume, The OECD's Historical Rise in Education, The Formation of a Global Governing Complex. The book was published in 2019 by Palgrave Macmillan as part of the Global Histories of Education book series. Christian is an associate professor in the Department of Culture and Learning at Aalborg University in Denmark. He's the primary investigator on the research project, The Global History of the OECD in Education, which I believe is the wellspring of this edited volume that we're going to discuss today. And while his home is decidedly in Denmark, he's also been a visiting scholar in Scotland and in England, most recently at Oxford University. Christian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Elisa. Thanks for having me.
So I must begin by congratulating you and your collaborators on making something like the OECD this interesting.
Thank you very much.
Because that's a tall order. I've seen some of the source material that I think you've worked with, and it can get to be a little dry. So I want to reassure everyone who might be listening that this conversation will not be dry because it's based on a book that actually makes the OECD something quite fascinating and much more complex and layered than I think we might assume on the outside. So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in the history of education?
Well, when I first applied for my PhD scholarship, it was a scholarship already defined. It was defined as a history of testing. So even though I'm a general historian who didn't know much about history of education, you know, I applied for this scholarship and then I sort of became specialized in the history of testing and assessment in Denmark primarily, but with a very transnational and outward-looking perspective about how intelligence testing moved from Paris to Stanford, moved to Scotland, moved to England, and also to Denmark and Scandinavia in a wider sense. So that was sort of my main stepping stone into the field. After that, I was fortunate enough to be part of a big research project on the history of UNESCO. So, and there we looked at the impact of UNESCO in historical perspective. And well, basically, when you put these two stepping stones together, the testing and UNESCO, well, when I had to define my own research project, yeah, then came up the OECD.
Right. It makes perfect sense. A logical stepping stone. So when we're thinking about the OECD and you know, how you got there through testing and through UNESCO, how do you see those two pieces as connecting to form your pathway to the OECD?
Well, I think there are very significant differences, of course, between UNESCO and the OECD. And it's not to say that UNESCO isn't engaged in testing, because they are, especially in Latin America. But they do have some particular traits when I look at the OECD, and that is exactly the testing, the assessment, the indicators. So that's really what I wanted to explore further. And then I discovered this whole wonderful field of research about global education policy, global education governance, but not many people in that field work with it from a historical perspective. So I still found that there to be like a niche that I could step into.
Well, three cheers for the historians. We're always very interested in looking backwards to understand how we got today, which I think is really, you know, the thrust of the contribution of this book. And you make some really interesting arguments about kind of the nature of power that the OECD wields when it comes to global education. And I do think that that's something that's that comes out of historical analysis. It's very hard to see kind of in the, if you start from the present.
Exactly. Because if you look at the present, you know, there isn't much questioning of the role of the OECD, actually. It's sort of assumed that, of course, the OECD is a legitimate player in the field of global education, essentially, especially with the PISA program and all its sort of offspring programs, and we can get back to them later. But it wasn't sort of, it wasn't written in the stars to begin with that the OECD was going to work in education, you see. It was very much established on the basis of the Organization for European Economic Cooperation called the OEEC, which was formed in 1948. In connection with the American Marshall Aid to Western Europe. So that organization was engaged in distributing this Marshall Aid, but also in trying to create an ideological fog screen against the communists in the East. So it was also a question of how you would commit Western Europe to the American way of doing business. So they had something called the European Productivity Agency. And in the book, Regula Bürki has written a chapter on that. And the interesting thing in terms of education here is that the Americans would invite business leaders, politicians, decision makers, union leaders, even to the United States to see how things are done or were done in the United States. And they would sort of take back that knowledge to Europe. So it was an effort to sort of mold Western Europe in the American image in a way. And it only makes sense when you take into consideration the Cold War, the bipolar context of the Cold War. So it's very much about economics at first, but then comes the Sputnik shock in 1957. And that really created shock waves through the Western world. And there was a very strong opinion among decision makers that something needed to be done, and especially in the field of technical education, engineering education, because otherwise you would lose the space race, essentially. So that really put education on the agenda within the OEEC. And then they created this program called the Mediterranean Regional Project, where they wanted to look at how sort of backward regions of Europe could be improved or boosted from educational initiatives. Better education planning, better investment in education. So that became sort of like a template for a lot of the OECD's early programs in education. Then the organization transitioned into the OECD in 1961, because you could maybe say in the late 50s that, well, why do we need this organization? Why don't we just shut it down? But I think there was still a very strong sense among the Western nations that it was really good to have a forum where we can get together, where we can discuss and talk and lay plans, and we view the world in the same way. And, you know, the United Nations system, it's really bureaucratic, and you have to listen to what the Global South has to say, essentially. So maybe it's not such a nice thing to say, but I think that was a very an important factor in keeping the OEEC around. And then it transitioned into the OECD because the United States and Canada joined. And there you would see a strong focus on education in the 1960s. culminating with the establishment of the Center for Educational Research and Innovation in 1968. So in that sense, it was, I'm not sure if it was like a coincidence that education came on the agenda, but certainly it wasn't there right from the start. But then it sort of gained a momentum within the organization. And of course, now the PISA program is one of the most important programs that the OECD even runs altogether, even though it is still, in essence, an economic organization, right?
And I think that's so fascinating, this part of the story, how I guess because the OECD is born as part of this Cold War context, it's a quintessential Cold War institution. You know, as you say, it's really born in this kind of insider capitalist club, trying to make sure that club remains and potentially expands, and that education gets swept up into this kind of Cold War logic. And I think nothing distills this change in the thinking around education more aptly than the quote by Francis Keppel with which you begin your chapter, the opening chapter of this book, which I'm sure everyone has heard, but I didn't know certainly that it came from this early OECD conference from 1961 in Washington, where he says famously, "The fight for education is too important to be left solely to the educators."
Yeah. Exactly.
Can you read that citation for us kind of historically? Because it's one that is, you know, seen on posters, but what does it really mean when it was said at that time?
Well, it meant first and foremost that education has a distinct geopolitical component, that it's also about power relations. And there are some other interesting quotes that I found in the US National Archives about high-level officials seeing education as a vehicle for really exporting the American way of life, but also retaining American and expanding American influence in the world. So this idea that education, it's not just about, you know, curriculum and didactics and learning and getting smarter or stuff like that. It's also about geopolitics. And the Sputnik shock is certainly a catalyst for that. And I think that is in this sense that we should understand this quote that you mentioned. We can't just leave it to the educators to think about education. It's much, much too important in terms of geopolitical influence and the geopolitical positions of nation states and even ideological components also, not least in the Cold War.
So in a sense, the way that education becomes associated with the OECD, or the way that the OECD associates itself with education, you know, from the early 1960s, you know, going forward now into the PISA era, is one in which, and this is a tension that you kind of distill in the book, between a humanistic or an economistic understanding of education, and that the OECD gets to the topic of working in education through that economistic portal. And in some sense, I think pushes out humanistic concerns, or what we might think about, you know, as pedagogy or anything that is outside of the kind of economistic production factor sphere. So, and some of the contributions in the volume really address the emergence of this economistic thinking around education. So how do you see this emerging, and how do you see the OECD as kind of grabbing on to these ideas in order to muscle itself a place in the international landscape?
Well, first and foremost, in the approach to education, which is very much about investment in education and manpower planning, developing of indicators, a sense of comparison at first, and later on maybe more sort of competition among education systems or economies, as the OECD likes to call it. So it is, it's true that I draw this distinction in the book. And it makes sense when you look at what is the purpose of education, because in many people's opinion and in many countries, you know, education is first and foremost seen as a provider of an educated labor force that would, you know, sustain the labor market and increase the gross domestic product. Whereas others would say that education also has a purpose in developing and enriching the human being and equipping the individual for leaving rich lives in the context in which they live. And it becomes very clear in a Danish context when you contrast the 1970s with the contemporary time, because in the 1970s, the purpose of education really was to educate critically oriented, democratic, happy citizens. So that was the purpose of education, really. Whereas now it's much more about, you know, boosting competences, making sure that you are able to cope on the labor market of tomorrow. So in that sense, you are essentially your own little business, you know, you're cultivating your own CVs, making yourself employable. All the sort of the, in a way, what some people would call the new liberal turn or the new liberal transition of the human being, right? So that's the contrast that I like to draw, because clearly, you know, I mean, whenever you open up a black box of history, you know, things gets nuanced, right? And of course, in the OECD isn't just the OECD, you know, it has multiple offices, departments, and projects populated by sometimes very different people, especially the sort of temporary projects where they would get experts from different countries, from different contexts to work. And they might have some of these sort of more humanistic ideals, and that might also reflect in OECD reports. But even so, I find that as long as they draw on the work of Erik Hanushek, for instance, who is a famous economist of education, and who has been making this argument about an increase in PISA scores will generate a rise in a gross domestic product, then I would argue that the most sort of influential trend-setting publications of the OECD fall within what I call the economistic approach to education, even though you might find some, you know, diversions, or even also now in PISA, they talk about how you can also implement soft skills, you know, appreciating the multicultural nature of the world, sense of collaboration, those sort of things. But in PISA, it's always very, very strongly connected with the economistic competences that you need to develop in order to be able to stay employable in a globalized world.
This really is at the heart of what you identify as the kind of power of that the OECD wields, which is this constant intervisibility, this constant comparison, this constant competition, this pitching one against another or multiple against each other, and that is distilled with these data sets, really, that is somehow the baseline by which we can perceive the other. That's what it seems is really one of the nodes of power of the OECD. Yeah. And I think one way that you describe it really well is by explaining that this power, particularly among policymakers of the OECD, comes from the fact that they provide numbers to which policymakers and politicians can ascribe narratives.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful phrase, I think, because it gives us a sense of kind of the hard spine behind everything that is layered on top is really this, what is quantified.
Hmm. Exactly. It is all about how can you make the world comparable? And for doing that, you need to say all other things being equal, which means that you have a complete disregard for context. So the OECD's governing mechanisms is very much, you know, as you say, the data, which they actually took over from the member states, because in the early years, they had problems with member states feeding the OECD with very diverse data and different definitions. And, you know, so they couldn't really compare them. So the OECD sort of took over the data gathering, and they now have this huge data bank, and they have much more data than the nation states do. So in that sense, that's also an incentive to stay on, you know, this super tanker that the OECD really is. But also the development of policy instruments, for instance, like PISA, they have engaged in policy evaluation. Also what is called the multilateral surveillance among member and participating states. And it just means that, you know, maybe you, I don't know if you've heard that concept about the epistemic community, but it's sort of the same idea that the high-level officials, politicians, but also to some extent practitioners who are involved with the OECD or experts, they sort of come together in the OECD and they share a view of the world, or they come to share a view of the world in terms of problem identification, but also in terms of problem solutions. And when they come back to their own context, you know, they sort of been influenced by that. So they share an episteme, you could say. So the multilateral surveillance is that you also create instruments that make very visible whether you are green, yellow, or red in terms of different indicators. And of course, it's not such a funny thing as a high-level official to come to a meeting in the OECD and your country is all red. You know, you want to be green, right? You want to be part of the good company. So in that sense, even though the OECD doesn't have a specific mandate to work in education like UNESCO does, it still is able to wield this kind of power by multilateral surveillance, but also, as you said before, the data and the creation of the data that allows different interpretations. For sure, it allows different receptions in different countries. So you wouldn't just say that, so everything becomes the same. It's like an extreme version of world culture theory or something like that, where the world just becomes, you know, identical, but more that politicians, decision makers also get this OECD data and maybe also some OECD policy recommendations, but then they sort of translate them into their own context. So there are some examples of the OECD maybe not wanting to go as far as the member countries have done. So Sweden is one example. They have for-profit schools, something that now the OECD warns of, you know. And in Denmark, there was an example that the high-level officials in the ministry wanted to have national tests for ranking purposes, whereas the OECD, the head of the OECD delegation, which was Peter Mortimer, Professor Peter Mortimer from London, said, well, don't do that. Please don't do that. It would be a mistake to do that. But even so, they continued. So it's not to say, you know, everything becomes the same, but it's just that the data is made available and the OECD sort of holds this sort of promise in a way that's sort of built into this sort of legitimacy that it wields, that if you are doing well in our programs, if you are green all along the scoreboards, if you follow our policy recommendations, we guarantee or we can assure that you are on the right track in this competition that is globalization. And your nation is on track to be prosperous and successful. And I think that's a very, very powerful narrative that also explains why countries keep joining PISA and keep engaging with the OECD programs. They dare not opt out, to put it in another way.
So so interesting, really well explained. And I think what you've just come to describe is what the subtitle of the book and what you put forward as a global education governing complex that is this mix of various factors that is a form of governance, economistic thinking, and education and soft power and all kind of snowballing into this kind of diffuse but also very particular nature of the OECD's power. But the OECD, as you say, and I think maybe we should come back to this, isn't born as an educational organization, right? The one that should be is UNESCO. That has it in the title. That is its mandate. And at some point in the 60s, UNESCO really is the kind of clearinghouse for educational data. They're the ones that have the best data from the most places. And they lose ground. I think after 1968 is really a big turning point, right? With massive global critiques of a very banking model, to use Paulo Freire's term, education systems. And at that moment, you see that UNESCO, particularly then in the 70s, kind of loses ground. And I think the OECD gains ground with the foundation of CERI in the 1968, but also the World Bank is in the background, starting to get really interested in education products under Robert McNamara. So how do you kind of think through the OECD's transition in the late 60s and 1970s? Because I think we focused, on the 60s and on now, but what about that period there? What's happening?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because it's actually some of the things that's most difficult to investigate in terms of historical sources, because it's like a wall, these international organizations, they just seem to be working together and be aligned in many ways. And it's still so, they seem to all gather around the Sustainable Development Goals. So now the OECD would say that their Education 2030 agenda is perfectly sustaining and underpinning the Sustainable Development Goals. But if we look at the early period, as you ask about, clearly when the OECD set up its headquarters in Paris, the UNESCO was really worried about it. So in the UNESCO archives, you will be able to find archival sources that sort of, you just get everything in the boxes, also internal memos and stuff like that. And that's really interesting because there you can see how worried they were. They said, so the OECD is imitating our work, that we might now compete over the same kind of staff, because they set up their headquarters in Paris like UNESCO did. They already had their headquarters there. So there is this anxiety in UNESCO. But still in that period, UNESCO had at least, I would say, a lot of legitimacy, especially with the Global South and the developing nations. And the OECD sort of only slowly moves into that area. So they become interested in the 1970s in social policy, social indicators, and they develop also the ISCET system, that is the standard education statistics system, together with UNESCO, or they adopt the UNESCO system. So in that sense, the UNESCO was still like a trendsetter. There's a little sort of side story to this because you're right in what you said about the clearinghouse in UNESCO, and that sort of evolved into what we now know as the IEA, the International Association for the Evaluation of Educational Achievement. So it's also an organization that works with what we call international large-scale assessments. And they sort of sprung from UNESCO and they run the TIMSS and the PEARLS, ILSAs. And a lot of that methodology that the IEA actually developed fed into the OECD and the early PISA. In 1988, the OECD launched the ENIS project. It's the Educational Indicators or International Indicators program. And a lot of the methodology came from the IEA, also not least because Andreas Schleicher, who is, well, perhaps known as Mr. Peace nowadays, he came from the IEA, so he had intimate knowledge about their methodology. So in that sense, there's a methodological string that sprung from UNESCO initially, ran into the IEA, which is still around today, I should say, and then fed into the OECD. And that helped boost the OECD's position. And there are also some scholars who mention how the United States was very keen to get the OECD to be the leading statistics organization. So there was a lot of critical reviews of UNESCO statistics in the 80s and 90s, which, I mean, might also have helped the OECD to sort of swoop in and become the major player over UNESCO. And apart from that, you know, UNESCO has always been incredibly underfunded, especially because of the UK and the United States, who had some very sort of ambivalent relations or ideas about UNESCO. Particularly right-wing groups in the United States would be very, very sort of skeptical towards UNESCO because they feared it would be anti-patriotic. And they had this idea about, global citizenship. They feared like a world government coming from UNESCO. So even though there were a lot of people very, very fond of UNESCO in the United States and also in the office, in the government departments, but, you know, it's been an ambivalent relation, right? And it came very much to the fore in terms of funding. So the UNESCO never had the muscle that the OECD had to do these things, international comparisons. Yeah, exactly.
Follow the money. It's very often, very often leads you to some answers. So you talked about, you know, this critique of UNESCO statistics towards the end of the 20th century, the OECD kind of swooping in to try to find its place as a purveyor of really, you know, excellent statistical work. How do you as a historian engage with the kind of sources that you work with to write this history, and also with data as a historical source? How do you extract information from what can be, I think, you know, quite dry, self-serving, bureaucratic reports? How do you really get the tensions that are that are being masked
well, I guess,
by those types
I guess,
of documents?
At first glance, some of the things might be a bit dry, but, you know, speaking as a historian, you know, I've never encountered once a topic that wasn't interesting once you got to, you know, understand it. And it's very much the same here. Well, in terms of the sources, it's mostly based on archival sources collected in the OECD archives and the UNESCO archives in Paris, and then also in some national archives in the United States and Brazil, to some extent China and Denmark. And the idea here really was to be able to follow the ingoing, outgoing mail from the OECD headquarters, and then see that. So how would that be received then in the national context? Because while in the OECD archives, you don't get all the internal memos. I mean, you can get it, but you have to be very specific in asking for what you want to see, and then it has to be approved. And maybe you don't know what you want to see. Maybe you just want to see everything about the 60s or something like that. And that's too vague, you see, so you can't get that. But in the national archives, there you would often get the writings of the high-level officials saying, you know, writing little memos about, so now we receive this and maybe it should go to that department. We need to get some input from this or that person, or, you know. And so in that sense, it's been really interesting to follow the policy instruments into national contexts. And then on top of that, you can get the interviews where you can get people who were there, retired officials who will explain maybe some things that you can't find in the archives, you know, something about, you know, moods and meetings, relations, priorities, antagonisms even among people or departments, the kind of thing that you often don't find in official minutes from one of these organizations. So it's been really, really wonderful to explore this material and also to actually go to the OECD and visit this sort of where you sort of feel that you're in the very center of globalization. Once you pass through security and you enter the big lobby where you have all the screens with all the meetings that are currently going on in the plenary rooms, then you really get an idea of how comprehensive this is. And that's where you get this feeling that you now stand in the very center of globalization.
I remember I had that experience when I went to the World Bank and I went to its cafeteria. I remember seeing, you know, it's these kind of these peripheral spaces, you know, the entry hall, the cafeteria of these big international organizations, but they tell you so much about the pulse. And I remember at the cafeteria, every single food in the world was present and every single nationality seemed to be represented. It really gives you, you know, that visceral feeling of the pulsing center of globalization.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've really focused our conversation on the first part of this book, the most historical section about the origins and rise of the OECD in its education work. And I wondered if you could describe for our audience briefly, you know, sections 2 and sections 3 of the book, if that was something that...
Yeah, it's true. The first part is very much about the first period and the very sort of historical background. And in the second part is where we look at specific nation states and national context. So we look at Australia and Brazil and Denmark and China and the Southern Cone countries in Latin America. So so that is where we really try to trace these policy instruments from the OECD into these national contexts. Whereas the third part of the book then is about how we look at the programs in a global perspective. So that's really a tour in the helicopter or even the space shuttle, actually, to get a look at what kind of trajectories and patterns do we see at the global level. So that is sort of the movement of the book from history to the national and then to the global level.
So as we kind of bring this to a close, Christian, tell us a little bit about what you've recently been working on since this book came out 2 years ago now in 2019, and what you're thinking about working on next.
Yeah, I'm currently working on a project on the paradoxes between assessment and inclusion. And as you know, in an academic career, you know, it's... your former project is always like a stepping stone or a catapult for the next one. So I became really interested in human diversity and also going back to this the humanistic approach to education and UNESCO's work in the Global Education Monitoring Report, the one on inclusive education that came out a couple of years ago. And then I sort of said, well, so if the world is sort of so hooked up on assessment and indicators, as we've seen in the OECD project, then I wanted to look at how what are the human condition under that sort of reign. So that's why I went to explore these paradoxes, because I think there are some paradoxes there. It's about testing and assessment is very much about saying, so who is good enough? Who can contribute in the right way that we want them to? Whereas inclusive education is more about, well, everyone is good enough and everyone is a valuable contributor to like a classroom or a learning experience or whatever. So, and that's exactly the paradox that we're now exploring also in a large comparative project between Argentina, England, and Israel, China, and Denmark. Of course, we're not covering the whole countries. It's just we look at practices in these different countries and how do they actually balance concerns about assessment with concerns about inclusion or human diversity. So that's what I really look at now.
Well, I think this is a really interesting and promising, you know, new direction, because this is really the political moment, and I think of this decade, which is, do we continue to focus on what we talk about as equality, which we then reduce to these indicators, right? So that there is this false baseline idea, or do we think about equity, which I think is closer to the idea of inclusion, that everyone has access to the same possibilities and opportunities, which the numbers can hide, the numbers can obfuscate.
Absolutely.
Christian, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about this book. I really urge anyone who's interested to understand a little bit more about the black box of the OECD to pick it up. And it's a read that really rewards. I think you can spend, a few hours with the book and get a lot out of it. And it will very helpfully explain to you what all those acronyms are that if you aren't, fluent in the language of an international organization, will kind of tend to muddle things more than clarify things. So thank you so much. And I hope that we can speak again soon when the next book comes out.
Thank you very much. And thanks for the interest.